This week, our cast was the comedian Les Dawson. Les, how do you feel about this desert island proposition? Could you take loneliness for a fair amount of time?
I think so, because I've played enough clubs to be lonely.
Some of those clubs.
But may I say, first of all, that it's such a pleasure to be closeted with you in this technological cupboard. And I think that, in fact, you've given me a confidence that I hitherto hadn't felt. And your opening remark was such that, for a moment, I was thrown there. Yes, I have been lonely on several occasions. And being a comedian is lonely.
What would you be happiest on this island to have got away from?
I think I hate indifference. I think indifference is probably the greatest killer. Mm-hmm. Indifference towards neighbours, to indifference towards people or children, whatever it is. I mean, the whole of life is basically one of being together. And I think indifference is... it's pretty rotten, and I've been married for 20 years, and I've had indifference every year, you know, year of my life.
How did you set about choosing just 8 records to last for a long, long time?
Records that would remind me of what I'd had before, or what I'd known before. Nostalgic discs, if you like, I suppose, which would remind me of things in the past.
What's the first one you've chosen?
The first one I've chosen is a wonderful piece by Ravel, the French composer, who I had great admiration for, because I used to play the piano seriously many years ago. Mm. In fact, many people said there's only one difference between myself and Chopin. He'd been dead longer than I had. And I think Ravel's Pavane for Infant Defunct is the ultimate in beauty.
Ravel's Pavane for a Dead Infanta, played by the Orchestra of the Suisse Romande, conducted by Ernest Ansomé. Now, I know you were brought up in a fairly run-down area, if one can call it that, of suburban Manchester. Did you know actual hardship as a boy?
We lived in a road called Miracle Road. And the reason why it was called Miracle Road is the houses stood, it was a miracle. To give you some idea of the way we lived, up to the age of 15, I thought knives and forks were jewellery. But my mother always did her best to give me something nourishing. I've known the times, right, when she's taken the bones from her corsets to give me something nourishing. No, it wasn't easy. It was a really harsh upbringing, really. Yeah. My father was superstitious. He wouldn't work if it was a Friday of the week.
What were you good at school?
Essays.
Were you, at that age, were you a comic? Were you the school jester?
Yes, by the sheer physical size of me, because I was fat. And the thing is, when you're fat, you can't run and you can't fight, so you have to be merry with people and pleasant.
Now, as we know to our cost, somebody taught you to play the piano. Whose idea was that?
Well, it's a long story, you see, because I used to play the piano when I was a child, and the neighbours loved it. They used to break the windows to hear me better. And my father used to help me to keep time by banging the lid up and down on my fingers. And from then, I sort of progressed, and I did my first concert, which is always a sort of salutary lesson for any child entering the music business. It was my first school concert, and when I'd finished playing this piece, the kids just stamped their feet and clapped with their hands all over me, and I really began to realise that I had a musical career, you know.
What was your first job when you left school?
And my first job?
Yeah.
I was an apprentice electrician.
What did you want to be? What had you got in mind?
Anything apart from being an apprentice electrician.
You were pretty good at boxing.
Yes, I was a boxer, yeah. In fact, I was the only boxer ever carried the ring as well as out. I was carried out of the ring so often I had handles on my shorts. And my father was very good on this. He said to me one night, he said, "Give it up, son." I said, "We've not left the dressing room yet, Dad." And I reeled then that the career had come to an end because I am basically a coward.
The time for national service came along. What did you opt for?
For desertion. They wouldn't accept that, so I went into the tank corps. I became a tank driver.
Yes. And your impressions of Al Jolson in regimental concerts are still spoken of by your comrades with awed reverence.
And that's only the Russians.
Was that the first time you faced an audience?
Yes, it was, actually. The full story of this is, if you want to, do you want the truth on this programme? Yes, are we being man-to-man face-to-face?
Man-to-man face-to-face.
In this ridiculous surroundings in this summer. Well, the absolute truth was I got 48 days detention for going absent without leave.
Where did you go?
I didn't go anywhere. I got caught just as they went out of the perimeter of the wire. There was a big fella there, much bigger than I. In fact, he had shoulders like the Cotswolds. And he bundled me up into a small heap and took me back again. But because of that small misdemeanour, I got 48 days. Luckily for me, it was Cambria Day in the tank corps, which, of course, is the first time that tanks were ever used in any sort of mechanised warfare. It was the First World War, Cambria, 1915. And there was nobody to play the piano. And so they dragged me out of the guardhouse, whatever it was, and they marched me briskly to the piano. I played the piano and never went back. Which was why we still have a British Army.
Good. Let's have your second record. Watch that.
Well, there's a record that's now currently popular, and it reminds me so much of Lancashire life, the sort of seediness of Salford, mist from the canals, and you can find beauty in anything you care to look for.
Indeed.
I can even look at my wife sometimes and see beauty, but I mean, that is really a tax of the imagination. But this record really sort of sums it all up. And it's called, he painted Matchstock Men and Matchstock Cats and Dogs.
Yes.
It's about Lowry, the painter.
You knew Lowry, didn't
yes,
you?
Yes, I met Lowry, yeah.
He painted Salford, smoke it up, some cardboard boxes from the shop, and parts of Ancoats where I used to play. I'm sure he once walked down our street, cause he painted kids who were out on the feet. The clothes he wore had all seen better days. Lowry didn't care much anyway. They said he just paints cats and dogs and matchstock men in boots and clubs, and Lowry said that's just the way they'll stay. And he painted matchstock men and matchstock cats and dogs. He painted kids on the corner of the street and was barking. Outside them factory gates, the paint is matchstock men and matchstock cats and dogs.
Matchstick men and matchstick cats and dogs, sung by Brian and Michael. What happened when you came out of the army?
Well, I couldn't settle because I once had a very sort of upsetting experience in the army, apart from what I've just disclosed to you, and that was the fact that I couldn't get up in the morning. I was court-martialed. And the officer at the court martial said, "Don't you hear the bugle?" I said, "No, they play when I'm asleep." And so I found myself in, as I don't know, in the horns of a dilemma. When I came out of the army, I couldn't settle. There was nowhere to go. My parents disowned me. And so I thought, "Oh, I'll go to Paris." I wanted to be a writer.
Yes.
I'd always had this beam in mind to be a writer, so I gravitated to Paris, which I thought was the absolute Valhalla for the arts in the
Had you
days.
Done any writing?
Yes, in the army I had, yes. The Soldier magazine, one or two bits and pieces, you know.
Yes. What were you trying to write?
Essays.
Essays.
You see, I'm a great Thomas Chatterton fan.
Yeah.
Well, not many, you know, your listeners probably heard of Chatterton, but he was a great poet. He died when he was 18. And he wrote that marvellous couplet, "Hither, old Dewey, from a convent cell," which to me summarises the very essence of beauty untouched, you know. So, because I wanted to be like the Elia Lam. I wanted this sort of syndrome, which didn't work.
You weren't going to make much of a living writing essays. How did you live?
I played the piano.
Where?
In a brothel.
Yes. Successfully?
The brothel was successful. I wasn't. And to be perfectly sure, the place was a brothel. I didn't know at the time. I must be perfectly honest. I was engaged, as far as I knew, to play the piano from 3 a.m. till 6.
How long did the Paris experiment last?
A year.
Why did you give it up? I mean, was the piano playing falling off, or the essays?
No, it was just starvation. I couldn't take it anymore. I was so thin, they were using me as a hat rack. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to come back home. I had my tail tucked well between my legs, and I came back to my parents. And I still miss Paris. I loved it, and it was very nice.
Let's have another record. What shall we have?
Well, I would like to have a remembrance of Paris. Spending those marvellous and somewhat lonely days on the Quai d'Orsay, and listening in the Tuileries Gardens to, well, to me, one of the most fantastic singers in the world. And she, when she did No Regrets, I thought it was marvellous. Of course, the Edith Piaf.
Avec mes souvenirs, j'ai allumé le feu. Mes chagrins, mes plaisirs, je n'ai plus besoin de balayer mes amours avec leur trémolo. Balayer pour toujours, je repars à zéro. Non, rien de rien. Non, je ne regrette rien, ni le bien.
Edith Piaf, I regret nothing. So, you came back to England. What happened? Back to the piano?
No, it was a bit of sort of a limbo period. I lived in London for a while and had a succession of jobs.
From what sort of jobs?
Well, professional babysitting to washing pots in Lyons' cafes, you know, things like this.
Yes.
Only because I could get 3 meals a day.
Had you started comicking at all yet?
No. No, because oddly enough, although, as I say, in the earlier, the formative years of my life, that the only way I could succeed with any society was by being funny, because I had nothing going for me, you know, physically. It's a bit rather like a sort of absurd orangutan. I really hadn't got down to the comedy field, so I tried playing the piano and singing a few songs and getting a few laughs, mainly when I sang and played the piano. So I started doing one or two clubs in London and didn't get me anywhere at all.
What sort of material did you use, apart from the piano play?
Well, it wasn't sort of doleful. It was sort of, hi there, I just love you people. It was sort of sounds like the American, because I thought you had to be like that, you see, and say wonderful, funny stories. And it died very successfully.
So that was the pattern for a few years. Club jobs when you could get them, and uninteresting jobs to keep yourself going.
Oh, very interesting. I sold babies' potties, for instance. One particular company is in Purvisory, where the advertising bill matter was the fact that you couldn't spill this potty. It was a non-spill potty.
Mm-hmm.
And they booked me as a rep for this, and I proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that you could spill this potty. So I didn't last very long. Yeah. So I was ousted once again. You know.
Now, there's a story about a job you had in a club in Hull which had a traumatic effect on your career.
Yes, there was a man called Al Heath. If he's still listening, I still bless him. He auditioned me at Max River Studios, which is a sort of Belson with lights. He invited me along there, I did this audition, and he paid me about £18 for the week to do a club in Hull. Well, it wasn't just one club, it was a series of clubs.
Mm.
And I don't think that any comic in the business has gone through what I went through. I mean, I didn't just die, I was resurrected nightly. We had people who used to throw tape measures, you know, I thought they were sort of undertakers. And I died the death of death. So the Thursday night I'd had quite sufficient. So I went to a place in Hull which is very old and steeped in history called the Land of Green Ginger, which is where Wilberforce and the slave business all began and ended. And I got completely and utterly incapable through drink. which isn't my maker. I don't drink much, you know. It's just the odd cup of coffee with probably spiced a little bit of brandy. And I got terribly stoned and I couldn't take any more. So I went back to this club and the curtains opened, which were very makeshift curtains. Very faded, very old. And I slumped on the piano and I couldn't rise. I was incapable of it. And I said, the first thing that came into my mind was, it's a great pleasure to be in this reconverted kipper depot. And they just spent £25,000 on the club. And the odd thing was, instead of being hooted off as I had in the past, I started to laugh. I began to realise what I'd done actually was be myself. Suddenly I realised what a phony I was. Complete and utter phony. And so it was a moment of truth. But once I did hear Dad as a Spanish, it's very true. I suddenly realised I was a flop. But I'd never seen it before, you see.
Yes. And you began to sort things out from then on.
Yeah, I'm still a flop, but I'm making more money. But the thing was that it happened then. I began to sort myself out. Yeah, very true.
A turning point, so let's have another record.
It was a turning point, yes, it was indeed. Well, there's a record which has very strange connotations, actually, in the fact that one of the first big dates I ever played was in the North East. And the top of the bill was an artist that I'd always admired. I'd have been on record and so on, and I followed him from music hall in the old days when they were still in existence. And he was so nice to me, this man. And his name is Billy Eckstein. And I think he did a marvellous record with Sarah Vaughan, which to me always reminded me of those days.
Seem like passing strangers now. How can you hurry by?
There were never two who loved half as much as you and I. We seem like passing strangers now. Funny how things can change.
We were so inseparable. Now you're acting very strange. The hands I used to touch don't even wave hello. Oh, I miss your lips. You'll never know.
If you would only turn to me, speak my name just once more, you might find right there and then.
Strangers can be lovers again.
Billy Eckstein and Sarah Vaughan, Passing Strangers. Now, what was the breakthrough? When were you able finally to become a full-time professional comedian?
It was about 1964. There was a show called Big Night Out at Blackpool. I had an agent in those days. I got a letter off him, which came as a shock, you know, and I went down to the office to see where he cleaned. And we talked about this. Basically, what it was, that Iris Fredericks, in those days, I think she still is, was the casting directress, I suppose, for want of a better word, at Thames Television, wanted a cheap stand-up comedian who was available. Now, there was only one man ever fitted that bill, and that was me. I was always available, always cheap. And they gave me a chance on a show called Big Night Out at Blackpool, which was a sort of summer follow-on from the London Palladium.
Yes.
And much to my chagrin, I might add, because I've been so used to dying now, because I was a Marty, you see, I was the second Latimer. I went very well. And it really started from there on.
And then came the radio series and the television series. You've done some plays on television.
Yes, yeah. There have been, you know, there are mixed sort of greetings about the press and by the public alike.
You've said that you'd like to play some Shakespeare.
Yes, I would.
You could play Falstaff.
Well, yeah, Prospero, In the Tempest, any of those people, yeah.
Record number 5.
I love modern music. And I think that in today's interpretation of the evocative sound of music, there's one record which stands out for my money, which has sort of great orchestral feel to it, and also the words are very nice. Is You Make Me Feel Brand New by the Stylistics.
My love, I'll never find the words, my love, to express.
to tell you how I feel, my love. Mere words could not explain. Precious love, you held my life within your hands, created everything I am, taught me how to live again.
Only you.
Make me feel brand new, the Stylistics. Now, the writing ambitions were still lurking, weren't they? You hadn't given that up, although you had cooled a bit, I think, on essays.
Yes, that's true, yes. Yeah.
In fact, you've written two books now, or is
yes,
it three?
No, I've got two books, and one on the one ready to be published.
Yes. Tell me about the two that have been published.
Well, the first one, in a strange sort of way, is it's not an autobiography, but I just thought that nobody's ever written about the lowest aspects of show business, the basics of show business, where it all begins, which was the clubs in the north of England.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some of those clubs were pretty bad, you know, they were grim. If they liked that, they didn't clap, they let you live. So I thought, well, somebody must write about these, and so that was the reason for the first book.
Yeah, what was that called?
Cab for the Clubs.
And the second one?
The second one was a complete take-off spoof of everything that had ever been written, which was called The Spy Who Came. I won't embellish on the title of it. It wasn't my choice, but that was the publisher's, which did quite well.
Now, what next? Which way do you want your career to go? Do you want to go on doing the clubs? Do you want to write?
I don't know, is it? Because there's something that nobody knows about, and I think I can confide in you. I've been friends for a long time, right? But I am very much concerned with conservatism of natural wildlife.
Mm.
And we do have a problem in our hands now, particularly with the horned whelk of Morecambe Bay. I'm finding indifference like a wall everywhere I go on this. The problem is that the whelk, one of our natural denizens of our shores, yes, is in danger of extinction because of silt, which is raised from the seabed because of people drilling for oil. This relentless search for natural minerals and so forth, yes, is destroying the very aspect of our land.
Mm-hmm.
What is happening is that the horned whelk has a very small nasal passage, so it relies on the search for a mate to its eyes. Its eyesight is all important.
Yes.
The silt causes stigmatism, and in some cases, the whelks are cross-eyed. We found the other week in Fleetwood that one whelk was trying to mount a discarded yoghurt carton, and we can't permit this, which shows, of course, its eyesight is no longer keen. And we're trying to open a chain of clinics from devices to the wash where whelks can be fitted with contact lenses and be reintroduced to the natural nautical life.
I'm very happy to hear this. I think it's time for another record.
Well, this is a record of a band who I had a great admiration for, and I'm unashamedly an avid fan. He's dead now, and he was never really the star that I think he should have been. I don't think women liked him. He was essentially a masculine comedian, and he endeared me with one line that was on his deathbed when a man called Schlesinger came to see him. And this particular comedian was laying in bed very close to his end. In one hand, he had the Bible, in the other, a glass of martini. And this chap came in, this producer, and said, "Mr. Fields, you of all people, the life you've led, you're reading the Bible, what for?" And this man gave the supreme exit line. He said, "I'm looking for a loophole." The man, of course, is W.C. Fields.
Yes.
I was driving across the Mojave Desert in search of the Lonesome Charlie gold mine. And by chance, I happened to come upon the Happy Buzzard gas station and tap room. I entered the tap room and said to the barkeep, "A double slug of red eye, please." And he replied,
"Sorry, no liquor, partner."
"What of the sign that swings outside proclaiming the Happy Buzzard? How can a buzzard be happy without a nip?"
"Well, this is election day, partner, and the bar is closed. It's the law."
"Who made this law?"
"The people voted for it."
"That's carrying democracy too far."
"Well, if you're so thirsty, how about a nice glass of water?"
"Are you insane?"
"Say, ain't you W.C. Fields?"
"No autograph, please."
"I guess I am insane, asking you to drink a glass of water. Well, I'd bet $100 you wouldn't do that."
"Of course I wouldn't. Did you say $100? The century note?"
"Yep."
"Get your money up."
"Okay. Here's my money, and here's your glass of water."
"Ugh. Hideous looking stuff. Don't you put an olive or a cherry or some formaldehyde in it?"
"Nope. Just plain water."
"All right. I'll drink it. May the state of Kentucky forgive me. Well, here's over the lip."
I must be seeing things. W.C. Fields is reaching for a glass of water. He's lifting it from the bar. There it goes up to his lips, and there goes my hunter. He's just starting to drink. No, he's putting it back on the bar. Whoops, he's lifting it to his lips again. He grits his teeth. By cracky, he's a-drinking that water. Well, Mr. Fields, what's wrong?"
"I'll get a doctor, you idiot. I've been poisoned."
W.C. Fields, an excerpt from The Day I Drank a Glass of Water. Now, Les, you're an ex-army man. You should be able to look after yourself on a desert island. You agree?
Yes, I think I could
build a shelter of some sort?
Yes.
Done any fishing?
Yes, well, my father used to send me shark fishing. And he always seems to get annoyed when a fellow's a hook.
Would you try to escape?
No, I don't think I'm that type of bloke. I think I'm too lazy to escape. I think if I found myself with any sort of reasonable shelter, I'd be rather inclined to stay there. There's a lot of coward in me.
Record number 7, what's that?
Well, the record, actually, I've chosen is evocative of the sort of song which I like, which is when one person stands alone on the stage, drenched in a spotlight, and has to sing a very moving song. And I thought the one that summarised my feelings towards this was Judy Covington when she sang "Don't Cry For Me, Argentina."
"Don't cry for me, Argentina. The truth is, I never left you. All through my wild days, my mad existence, I kept my promise. Don't keep your distance. And as for fortune and as for fame, I never invited them in. Though it seemed to the world they were all I desired, they are they're not the solutions they promised to be. The answer was here all the time. I love you and hope you love me. Don't cry for me, Argentina.
Julie Covington, "Don't Cry For Me, Argentina," from Evita. One more disc. What's that to be, Les?
Well, it's It's a pianoforte piece written by, which I consider one of the greatest composers ever, for Chopin. And the reason why I particularly like this record is it summarizes man's spirit in the face of adversity. And it's called The Revolutionary. I think I could listen to this record and think, well, if anything gets me down, here's a spirited sort of composition which will make me think, well, it's worth carrying on for. And that's why I've been married for so long. Every time I have a row with a wife, I play this. Last week I played it 16 times. So at least, you know, there's this sort of a belief that this is a number which will enable me to carry on against adversity.
Svatoslav Richter playing Chopin's Revolutionary Study. If you could take just one disc out of the eight, Les, which would it be?
I think I would take a record which would give me beauty, and therefore I would opt for Fels Bavanfre Infanta Defunct.
And one luxury to take with you.
Any piece of furniture belonging to the Georgian period, be it an escribier, or a desk, or a chair, because I think that when the Georgian period ended, civilization ended.
And one book, apart from the Bible, Shakespeare, and big encyclopedias.
A book that gave me a lot of pleasure, written by, I think, a marvellous author, Neville Shute's Trusty from the Tool Room, only because it summarises one small man's fight against a tremendous society in which he wins through, and I think I would like that.
Neville Shute's
Trusty from the Tool Room, yes.
And thank you, Les Dawson, for letting us hear your Desert Island disc.
And may I have the cheque now, please?
Yes, Mr. Dawson, indeed you may.